Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Today we're talking about music and the mind with a man who's an expert in both. Dr. Richard Kogan is a psychiatrist as well as a world-renowned concert pianist. He's known for his presentations on the psychology of the great composers, presentations that are half lecture and half recital, with Dr. Kogan illustrating his points by playing passages of music. Dr. Kogan is clinical professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City, where he's artistic director of the Music and Medicine Program. He'll be performing at Goucher College tomorrow evening and with the BSO on Sunday afternoon. We have details on our website. Dr. Richard Kogan joins us from a studio in New York. Welcome to On the Record.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me on your show.
How did you come to study the minds of composers?
You know, for many years, I was trained as a pianist. I went to a liberal arts college because I wanted to expand my base of knowledge beyond simple conservatory training. Got intrigued by the mind, decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist. But I decided that I wanted to be a psychiatrist not instead of being a pianist, but in addition to it. And for many years, I had kept up a cumbersome life with parallel careers as a psychiatrist and a pianist. And it was actually relatively recently that I started looking at the interface between the two, or the intersection.
Are you mainly using their biographies to do your analysis, or does their music tell you something in this analysis as well?
I think both, actually. I mean, there are a lot of scholars and musicologists who've done extraordinary research on all of the composers that I studied carefully, but I think ultimate clues to their psychology rest in looking at the music that they composed. Music kind of gives, in some ways, the best clues as to what they were thinking about.
Give me an example.
Well, you know, this weekend in Baltimore, I am going to be talking about Beethoven, and part of what's fascinating about Beethoven is his evolution as an artist. You know, scholars of Beethoven disagree about a lot of things, but there's a consensus that when you talk about music of Beethoven, you have to make a distinction between early Beethoven, middle Beethoven, and late Beethoven. There were significant stylistic shifts at significant junctures in his career. Early Beethoven hews very much to the Viennese classical tradition. He starts to lose his hearing, and after that, he transitioned into his middle style. He made a significant break. He actually made the statement before he started working on his third symphony, the Eroica, which in some ways changed the course of music history. He said, I must find a new path. What seemed to happen is that as he retreated into the silent world of his imagination, he was no longer hearing the music of his contemporaries. And so his music became considerably more imaginative. And by the end of his life, when he was completely deaf, and we listened to late Beethoven's style, you get the feeling that he was totally cut off from music that any of his contemporaries were writing. And so he was, in the silent world of his imagination, kind of free to conjure up sounds and forms that were different from anything that he or anybody had composed up until this point.
You describe that as kind of a liberation. I think most of us think of Beethoven's deafness and associate it with depression.
Well, it's an extraordinary story of resilience. By the way, he did become depressed. Deafness is a hardship for anybody. For a musician, it's catastrophic. And after he lost his hearing, he wrote something in which he very, very seriously contemplated suicide. But in the same document, he said he's going to hold off on his suicidal impulses and instead attempt to fulfill his destiny as an artist. And he actually became a much greater composer after he lost his hearing.
That's Dr. Richard Kogan, psychiatrist and concert pianist, here on the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Dr. Kogan will deliver two lecture recitals in Baltimore this weekend on the psychological life of Beethoven. Is there more mental illness among composers than in the general population?
Yes, in not just composers, but poets, writers, artists, musicians, the incidence of psychiatric illness does seem to be greater than in the general population.
Why would you think that is?
I think great art is frequently associated with conflict, suffering, challenge. And in many cases, the composer Tchaikovsky, for instance, he was a deeply, deeply depressed man. He chronically grappled with suicidal thoughts. I mean, a lot of the music that we associate with him, like the Nutcracker, Swan Lake, in this ballet music, he created these idealized fantasy worlds which represented a perfect escape from his really horrible internal feeling state. Other music that he wrote, like the Pathétique Symphony, which, by the way, was premiered 9 days before he died, and his death may, in fact, have been via suicide. In the Pathétique Symphony, he seems to lay bare his internal despondency. If somebody like him were more blandly content, he wouldn't have been motivated to write either the Pathétique Symphony or the Nutcracker. So some of these depressed individuals or people who are grappling with mental illness or other types of issues really need the outlet of art. Other of the composers that I've looked at, like Schumann, who seems to be a classic case of bipolar disorder, manic depressive illness, there are aspects of mania or the hypomanic state which are actually just conducive to creative achievement. The racing thoughts, the flight of ideas, sharpened imagination, increased energy, decreased need for sleep. Many of these bipolar individuals, they're very difficult to engage in treatment because many of them don't want to give up the creative highs associated with their mania.
Can you really diagnose someone who's been dead for a century or more?
No, it's challenging to do psychiatric diagnoses on historical figures. But, you know, with some of these 19th century composers, many of them kept meticulous diaries and wrote lots and lots of letters. So in some cases, we have information about their mental state for nearly every day of their adult life.
Give us a sense of what your lectures are like.
I create a narrative about a life, try to explore some of the psychological underpinnings of what they create, and then I illuminate this discussion through performances of the pieces. The music will feel like an illumination or an illustration of everything that I'm talking about.
How much of this do you do?
I do about 50 performances a year. I travel all over the world doing these performances.
What have you learned about the nature of creative genius from studying composers and their mental state in such depth?
When I started this project, and I started reading biographies of composers whose music I had played my entire life, I discovered that many of them grappled with many of the same issues that my patients struggled with. Looking at the struggle that these composers had really helped me play their music, because music, you know, ultimately, you look at this music, black and white notes on a page. If you practice hard enough, if you study properly, you can learn to play the notes. But ultimately, the job of a performer is to animate these notes. And I think learning some about their lives and understanding something about psychological processes really helps me, I think, try to have some sense of the framework of what might have been on the composer's mind while they were composing. And I think this brings performance to life. Similarly, I think living in the world of the performing arts puts me in touch with things like creative expression and communication in a way that most of my fellow psychiatrists don't. And that's extremely helpful in my life as a psychiatrist. I'm really mainly trying to help my patients reach their creative peak or creative potential, whatever they come in with. For most of them, their creative potential is not as high as Beethoven's, let's say, but it's higher than, you know, what they happen to be achieving in any given moment. And thinking about the sorts of things I think about as a musician, I think really helped me bring them there.
We're in an age where we rush to treat mental illness. Are we sometimes dampening creative genius by doing that?
You know, I was particularly concerned about that earlier when I first started thinking about these composers. What happens if I treat this mental illness? Am I potentially depriving the world of the next great novel or symphony? As I've studied them more carefully, I'm less concerned about that, because I think all of these individuals, they were determined to create. And if anything that I did or any other clinician would do would get in the way of the process, they would probably ignore whatever we were doing. The last time I visited Baltimore was in January. I did a program with Maestro Marin Alsop on Rachmaninoff. I even played the second piano concerto, which was dedicated to Dr. Nikolai Dahl, Rachmaninoff's psychiatrist, because after the failure of his first symphony, it was condemned by critics, and he fell into a catastrophic depression, actually, didn't compose for 3 years and had all the signs and symptoms of depression. He was brought out of this by Dr. Nikolai Dahl, who, in a course of hypnosis therapy, got him past his obstacles. And so his story, for instance, is a wonderful example of the value of clinicians. Even though mental illness is so overrepresented amongst these great creators, it's very important not to over-romanticize mental illness, because most depressed individuals, for instance, are not writing the Pathétique Symphony. They're too paralyzed to do anything. And most psychotic individuals, they're too disorganized to create anything that's coherent. So there is a place for mental health professionals in the lives of creative artists.
You study the healing effects of music. Tell us about that.
I think music is enormously underrated as a modality of healing. Music and medicine nowadays are thought of as separate domains, but it wasn't always that way. You know, the ancient Greeks, for instance, they designated Apollo as the god of both medicine and music. Many primitive cultures, the roles of physician and musician were played by the same person. You'd have the shaman, who'd sometimes use musical instruments, sometimes use medical instruments. They didn't make a distinction because they just wanted to heal. Music and medicine have drifted apart. My fellow healthcare professionals, it's important for all of us not to lose sight of music's really amazing capacity, well, to reduce pain for sure, to soothe anxiety, to lift spirits. I think music is a universally accessible way for people to feel better.
Is listening enough, or does one need to perform to get a real healing boost?
I think music is most therapeutic when it is engaged in most actively. I think music is often consumed passively and alone. I think 100 years ago, people were more apt to engage, for instance, in a song by gathering around a piano with others and actually singing. That sort of communal active engagement is going to be more therapeutic than somebody who's just plugged in to an iPod and listening alone.
Do you think the composers that you've diagnosed, the ones that you thought were mentally ill, were in some sense self-medicating?
Well, I think a lot of them were. Many of the people that we put in the pantheon of the great composers, certainly in the Western classical music tradition, lived prior to the era of effective psychopharmacology. But if you read their biographies, many of them, for instance, self-medicated with alcohol. And I think many of them talked about how desperately they needed music as a form of therapy. Tchaikovsky, for instance, a quote, he said, "Without music, I would go insane." He wasn't kidding.
This is so interesting. I think a lot of people are looking forward to your visit to Baltimore. Thank you for talking to us about it.
Thanks for having me on your show, Sheila.
Dr. Richard Kogan, psychiatrist and concert pianist. He is artistic director of the Music and Medicine Program at Weill Cornell Medical School. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to information about two presentations Dr. Kogan is making this weekend in Baltimore about the psychological life of Beethoven, tomorrow evening at Goucher College and Sunday afternoon with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra at the Meyerhof. I'm Sheila Kass. This is On the Record. We'll take a quick break now and then a Stoop story.